All right, welcome back to another episode of Theology Applied. I am your host, Pastor Joel Webben with Right Response Ministries. And in this episode, I'm privileged to welcome to the show for the first time, the Shampoo Warlord, also known as Charles Haywood. In this episode, Charles and I are discussing two men in particular, that is Elon Musk and Donald Trump. In regards to Musk, we're addressing the very real possibility of Musk now in Texas building a private security, which would really just be a thin-veiled army in the Republic of Texas. In regards to Donald Trump, both Charles and I think that it is virtually inevitable that Trump will be the next president of these United States, and that because he can't be stopped by all these other attempts, namely the courts, the real last measure left for the left is to take his very life. Will there be an assassination attempt on Donald Trump? These are the things that we are speculating and discussing, the possibilities, predictions for not the long-term future, but the short-term future right here in America. Tune in now.
Applying God's word to every aspect of life. This is Theology Applied.
All right, welcome back to another episode of Theology Applied. I am your host, Pastor Joel Webben with Right Response Ministries. And in this episode, I am very privileged to welcome to the show for the first time, hopefully not the only time, the true shampoo warlord. We have Charles Haywood. Charles, thanks for coming on.
I'm extremely pleased to be here.
Great. Well, you are known for probably a few different things, but I'm familiar with you from your position that you've articulated with your manifesto on foundationalism. I'm also familiar with your position. You are very bullish on Elon Musk, who I take as in a true Kuiperian spirit, as a common grace gift from God. That I'd much rather have Elon Musk over Twitter than Jack Dorsey or somebody else. Probably not as bullish. So I think let's talk about. I'd like to get to Elon Musk, but real quick, just for our listeners who are unfamiliar, talk to us about foundationalism. You've got pushback in the past about, he's calling for a violent uprising. And I read the manifesto and immediately, I was able to, I knew what you meant. You weren't saying, hey, all the conservatives should pick up, arms and go to war. You were saying, no, we already have violence. Do we not remember 2020, the summer of love? Half the country is, in flames. Eventually it'll get worse. And when it gets worse, inevitably not from the right, but from the left, this is how the right builds from the ashes. Is that a fair interpretation of what you were saying?
Absolutely. I mean, my kind of fundamental political premise is that the liberalism in Western civilization, enlightenment originated liberalism, has reached the end of the road because it has finally destroyed our society. And therefore, whether we like it or not, something else is going to replace that. We have been catechized our whole lives that liberalism, in the sense of enlightenment liberalism as opposed to political liberalism, which are subtly different things, is something that is inevitable. The era of progress points left. We get more emancipation. We get more egalitarianism. We get all the things that the original 1700s enlightenment theorists wanted, and that's the way it's going to be. We get more and more of that. Not only is that obviously not true, it's obvious that those things are all poisons that have destroyed our civilization. So we're coming to an end of that time. When exactly that will end and how that will end is, of course, remains to be determined. But that means that something else has to replace it. So I keep writing about this and people start asking me, well, Haywood, what's your solution? And the answer is that foundationalism. And foundationalism, however, is not an ideology. Foundationalism, or the Foundationalist Manifesto, as you mentioned, is meant to be a series of guideposts, pillars, to rebuild a civilization on the basis of reality rather than on the basis of ideology, which is what we have been given over the past 150 years or so in the West. Longer, but the true triumph of ideological thinking has really been the past 100 years. So we want to get away from ideology towards something that's reality-based. But of course, that's a right-wing system because reality has a right-wing bias. So necessarily, right, the future is going to be right-wing. There are many possible variations on that. It's going to be organic. That is, you want to have a system that arises from the raw material of the society, guided by right thinking, that is correct thinking. But you don't want to say foundationalism is this new system, and this time it's going to make everything perfect. I mean, it's never going to be perfect. I mean, that you know, as Christians, you know, this is a basic Christian belief that, you know, in the temporal sphere, we'll never have perfection. And this idea right. of chasing it is silly. So, you know, the idea of foundationalism as ideology, people always assume that. Like, I've seen some things circulating. I reject fascism, communism, foundationalism. I'm like, okay. I mean, those things aren't, that's a category error. Foundationalism isn't an ideology in that sense. As I say, it's a series of thought experiments and guideposts to help, once we're past the chaos that inevitably attends the end of one system, to build a better, newer system without promising a utopia.
Right. Right. So what are some of the, I did appreciate how painfully practical it was. I think that's well put. It was not, it wasn't ideology. It was just very clearly, these are some of the things that, not just that we shoulds, ought tos, like we ought to do these things, but really more of a prediction than anything, saying this is what will likely take place, that they'll, you know, as we see the West continue to crumble underneath its own doing, naturally the you know, counter revolution is going to be a rerooting in nature. That's for the record, I'm always, you know, telling some of our listeners and the church that I pastor, if you want to get into trouble, all you have to do is Christian theology that's rooted in nature. There's a war right now. Again, the pietism doesn't bother anybody. So if you only speak in spiritual terms about your personal quiet time and devotions and piety and these kinds of things, nobody's bothered. If you want to find, it seems random, but it's not random. If you want to find the common denominator in every major, you know, little semi-viral Twitter spat, it's always something having to do with nature. So men should work out, and all the Christians come out and say that's vanity, you know, or women should dress modestly, men should own a gun, or a nation should have borders, or I remember Eric Cohen got in trouble for his adoption tweet. I was adopted, so I'm a big fan of adoption, but I knew immediately what he was saying, that there are many cases where you shouldn't adopt. And certainly adoption should never disparage natural, you know, the being fruitful, multiplying, and natural born children. But the point is, all those, from adoption to working out to modesty to policies on borders, that I think the common denominator is things rooted in nature. And Christians, I think, for a very long time, especially Baptists, of which I am one, but Protestant Baptists, I think, have despised natural theology, despised nature, anything rooted in that. And so I appreciated foundationalism because for that very reason, it wasn't just mere ideology or even mere theology. It was just saying, this is the world that God has made. These are the principles that he's baked into the equation. They work. Anything that goes against this utterly fails, inevitably. So there will be a return to these things.
Yeah.
Any absolutely. Response to that?
No, I think that's entirely right. I mean, I use the word reality rather than nature, but those things are the same thing. And I think, right. I mean, much of what the 12 pillars of foundationalism revolve around that. Your sex role realism, the subordination of economics to politics, you know, nationalism, not globalism. These things are all just kind of obvious in the sense that a normal human being kind of surveying the world around him would say, well, these are the obvious kind of general paths to take when we're setting up a society. I do kind of part ways, and I get a fair bit of grief for the fact that I'm very big at the same time on space exploration, and I'm generally speaking a techno-optimist. So that doesn't fit. Some people think that doesn't fit well with reality-based or being based in nature. I think that's not true. I think that, you know, as I like to say, the works of man under the eyes of God. So, you know, that's where the space and techno-optimism comes in. Nonetheless, that's a relative only part of it. So it's all about nature.
Let's talk. I want to talk about the spacing, and that'll transition really well with Elon Musk, you know, and SpaceX. But before we do, could you just give us the 12 pillars and maybe just... I know that's a lot, but at least just list them. You don't have to go into detail explaining them, but just for the listeners, like what are these 12 pillars of foundationalism?
Absolutely. I would be happy to list the 12 pillars of foundationalism, but I'm going to have to call up my own manifesto here because I can't, I don't have them memorized per se. It's not like the Lord's Prayer. Okay. So the first pillar, space, second pillar, a mixed government of limited ends and unlimited means, virtue politics, sex role realism, the subordination of economics to politics, intermediary institutions, subsidiarity, hierarchy and order, Christian religion, high culture, techno-optimism, and nationalism, not globalism.
Great. Great. So let's talk about the spacing, because I think you'll find a friend in me, because now I'm not as bullish as you are on the particular person of Elon Musk, but in terms of space exploration, you know, I've got mutuals and friends, dear Christians that I love they think it's all a sham, you know, like they don't think we've been to the moon. I always tell people, you know, if somebody, you know, is questioning the moon landing, you need to show them that you're an even bigger conspiracist than they are. So you need to respond by saying, you believe in the moon? What a normie. You know, I don't even believe the moon exists. No, but I do think that space exploration, I'm post-millennial, and so I'm optimistic on the future. And I do think that God has baked resources here, you know, into the cosmos, but not here only on Earth, but in other places. The ability to split certain isotopes in a different gravity, you know, if you had a base on the moon or Mars, there's all these. We think of space as a desert, but I think there are vast resources that that we're just now starting to see, and the ability to perform certain experiments. And I think space will be integral to, I hate using the phrase these days because the Gospel Coalition ruined it, but human flourishing. So, but go ahead. What do you think about space? Why does that matter? If you love the Psalms, you're going to want to hear this. We all know that finding quality music that's theologically sound can be difficult these days. That's why the Psalms Project is putting together all 150 Psalms with every single verse included to artful, creative, professionally produced music without gutting or censoring the God-breathed text. The Psalms Project is led by Shane Heilman, a Reformed believer who holds to the 1689 London Baptist Confession of Faith. Here's a quick sample.
The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear?
To hear more music from the Psalms Project, including their new album for Psalms 47 through 55 that just dropped, go to thepsalmsproject.com. Again, go to thepsalmsproject.com today.
Well, I think that, I mean, I'll work backwards so you're off some of the stuff that you said. I mean, a lot of Christians are down. It's a weird kind of group of people who are down on space. You have a bunch of Christians and more generally conservatives who are down on space. You know, we have enough problems here, or it's impossible to actually access space in a way that makes it usable. And then you have people who are just think that space is a waste of time from a strictly non-religious perspective. I think that starting from a religious perspective, that I don't think there's any aliens, right? I mean, maybe there's aliens, but it seems extremely unlikely there's aliens. And that doesn't seem weird to me at all. It seems to me an infinite God, by definition, can create infinite universes. So the logical inference, or not logical inference necessarily, but a reasonable inference is that this universe is for us, just us, you know, men and women. And so we occupy this tiny space of it. So maybe God doesn't intend for us to get outside of this particular space, but there's a lot of space to go to if he does intend us to go elsewhere. And I don't, my own personal belief is that there's no other intelligent life out there.
I agree. Right. I don't think sentient human-like life, maybe some, you know, an animal or some kind of beast or something like that. Right.
But you know, so basically my opinion, and it's really my opinion, is that God made this universe for us, and maybe he doesn't intend for us to go further, but he hasn't expressed an opinion on the topic to us directly, and it's sitting there, so we should go get it. I do think there's many technological challenges to that, but from a strictly spiritual perspective, I think that makes sense. And the reason that I'm big on space exploration, which is tied to but not exactly the same thing as techno-optimism, the reason I'm big on space exploration is because I think it's important for, and again, I hate to use the word, but I use it all the time, human flourishing. As mankind needs this kind of aspiration in order to not fall backwards. Fundamentally, the way men and women are constituted, in men in particular, is that without some kind of external goal, they either stagnate or get up to some kind of bad activity among themselves. So you need a binding goal that it obviously has a bunch of drawbacks and, as I say, requires a bunch of technological challenges. But if we hadn't wasted the past 70 years doing the 70 years of stupid things we've done in the United States, we could easily imagine a position where we are well advanced on that path. Admittedly, it does require, for example, energy sources are a big problem. Fossil fuels are running out. My whole life, I've been hearing about how fusion is just around the corner. So there are a bunch of hurdles. But if we can achieve those hurdles, then it becomes space exploration becomes something that helps bind mankind together, which is a beneficial thing for any society.
Yep. Well, real quick on fossil fuels, are you familiar with the position that they're actually being regenerated? That it's not just dead animals of, so I'm a young earth guy. I've heard that, people starting to think, well, perhaps it's a geological kind of, different minerals and, under pressure and heat and, that they're being produced and reproduced every day.
Abiogenesis, I think it's called. I have no opinion. It seems unlikely to me that would replenish at the rate that's necessary, given the rate of use. That's somewhat different from space exploration, though. You're familiar with John Michael Greer?
No.
So Greer is he's not Christian. He's I think he claims to be a druid, but he writes a bunch of interesting things. And one of his points is that he is actually an excellent writer. Energy extraction becomes more and more expensive. There necessarily becomes a point at which the value you get out of extracting a unit of energy is exceeded by the energy you put into extracting that unit, which is undoubtedly the case unless there's very significant regeneration. But oil isn't going to get us to space. That is, we need something else that is you can't carry oil tankers to space in order to actually achieve things in space. I mean, yes, you can send probes around and so on, but ultimately you can't really do the things that are necessary to do in space without some more compact source of energy. And normally when someone says things to me, I say that's a first step fallacy. That is, you can imagine that this thing is possible, so you predict it's possible. But I'm not predicting this is possible. All I'm saying is that we're a smart group of people, we here in America and we here more broadly in the West and in some other countries, nations as well. Instead of focusing on making Ozempic, we need to be focusing on finding new energy sources. And maybe that's possible, maybe it's not. Even if we maintain using fossil fuels because they don't run out as fast as we expected for whatever reason, we still need new energy sources.
Right. And do you think nuclear or fusion is the way to go?
Well, fusion, especially. Like I say, ever since I was seven, I've been hearing commercialized fusion is 20 years away. And every headline, if you dig into it, recent headlines are all lies, just continuing that nothing is really happening. And it doesn't mean they shouldn't be trying, but it doesn't seem to be going well. And nuclear fission, I'm not an expert in this. I hear both arguments. Like some people say it's not being used because of regulatory overkill. There's other people who say that it doesn't work at all without without subsidies. I really have no opinion. But it's also true that electrical generation, which is what fission is only part of the energy puzzle. So even if we had much cheaper electricity, that wouldn't solve some of our other resource problems.
Gotcha. All right. Well, talk about Elon Musk. Why are you so bullish on him?
So I kind of ignored Elon Musk. I mean, he's basically my age, almost exactly my age. And he was this guy and he was in Silicon Valley and I knew vaguely who he was with PayPal and so on. And, I had, people who kind of knew him distantly and so on. But like, if you would ask me, like, I always confused him with Peter Thiel, like which one's German and which one's South African? Like, okay, guys born abroad. And then I started paying a bit more attention a couple of years ago. And my original opinion of Musk was, interesting guy, very entrepreneurial, And I think the first thing I wrote about him, like 5 years ago, I said he occupied a strange twilight land between con man and genius. And I think that's still true to a certain extent. But what's become clear is that as the regime that rules us fails, something ultimately arises in order to contest regime supremacy in any failing system. And Musk has the blend of things that make him that likely challenger. First of all, he has enormous wealth, which is always a useful thing. His personality is very, you know, he claims to be a little bit on the spectrum, you know, Asperger's. I'm not sure that's true or not. I think diagnosis is overrated, but he's not agreeable in the sense of the psychological trait of agreeableness. He has no interest in conforming to social norms or in being in, I mean, I think he does like to be invited to people's parties who I don't think he should associate with, but he's not desperate for people to pat him on the head. But most importantly, you're Musk. You're an atheist, more or less, I think, maybe 100%, maybe just, you know, agnostic or something. You have this goal, which is undoubtedly, and everyone agrees on this, the only thing he really, really cares about, which is getting to Mars. And mm-hmm. He has maybe 20 years left to get to Mars. You know, he's early 50s, and so, you know, maybe 25 years, but, you know, time and chance happeneth to them all. And so if you're Musk, you look around and you see that the regime will never let you get to Mars because they'll both hamstring you. You know, you'll have to have Shaniqua running your engineering or else you'll have to pay a giant fine. They stole $55 billion from him the other couple of weeks ago in order to either punish him for his free speech on Twitter or to indicate to him he better play ball or what have you. So he has, and his only response to that was, well, I'm going to reincorporate in Texas. Now, Elon Musk doesn't talk to me, but I can assure you that his internal thought process was not reincorporation is going to show him. It was my suspicion is he was, you know, a lot angrier. But the fact that he didn't say something that was angry is actually indicative of the fact that I'm right, that he's somewhere in there. At what level of consciousness isn't clear to me. He's saying that I have to completely destroy the existing regime and remake things in order to achieve my life goals. I think this is inevitable. Whether they'll succeed at that is not clear, but it's pretty clear that it's like a train track, right? Everyone's on their train track, going down their train track. They can't get off the train track. That's just the way it's going to be.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I think there's three questions. One is, can Elon Musk succeed in his goals without destroying our current regime? I think the answer to that is no. It has to be destroyed. Two, is he conscious of that reality? Does he know that? And is he committed to trying to take down the regime? I think the answer to that is yes. But then the third is, you know, will he succeed? And I don't know. I mean, even as I think about investments, it was, you know, a few years ago that, you know, I, and I'm not saying this like it's super insightful, me and everybody else on the planet realized that Tesla is probably not the best stock to invest in. And not because Elon can't be successful in what he's making. I would bet on a guy like Elon. But the whole world is against him. Like I feel like the stock price of Tesla is one of the ways that the regime has its claws in Elon, that at any point, you know, and also when you factor in the fact that so much of what he's doing, because all this seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like a relatively new development in the sense that Elon has just realized that maybe Democrats aren't great. You know, for the statement he made a couple of years ago, for the first time, I'm going to vote for Republicans. I thought the Democrats were the party of compassion, you know, and kindness. And I was like, wow, like for supposedly the world's smartest guy, you're pretty slow on the uptake when it comes to, you know, he's seeing through.
I think this is actually an important point. I mean, people.
Okay, go ahead.
Based upon his, you know, he took the SAT. People already took the SAT when it was a de facto IQ test. Now, of course, it has nothing to do with IQ for all the obvious reasons. But I think people have estimated his IQ at like 120. I don't think he is not supremely intelligent. I mean, he's not some kind of super, and that's actually good. Being super intelligent is a hamper. That is for a variety of reasons. But people with like 160, 170 IQs, typically are very bad at being leaders. And it is actually better that he's not super intelligent. But you're really talking about wisdom, not intelligence. Not the
right, you're right.
Spatially manipulate things. But it's a journey, right? That's my point. My point is he's on this journey, but it's on a train. And the train is on the track. Right. And there are no off posts except death. And so,
right. No, you're right. I definitely see the journey. Part of what makes me a little bit more bearish on Musk is the fact that I feel like he's starting at a negative. So on the one sense, you know, he's, I think, the world's second richest man right now.
That's right.
Is that correct? Yeah. So he's the world's second richest man.
That's because they spent $55 billion from him, though.
Right. He's incredibly successful. However, the problem is that because my point in bringing up this, you know, somewhat recent revelation of, hey, maybe Democrats aren't the good guys, and maybe their compassion and kindness is actually, you know, just a thin veil, and they actually are enemies of humanity. But because he's put so much of his efforts, it's not just any business, you know, or any products that he's been successful with. He's been largely successful in an arena that relies at least somewhat, if not arguably heavily, on subsidies, electric cars, you know, saving. He was the left's guy. And he was the environment guy. He's the guy who was going to save us from the sun monster, you know, monster. And so, if that's the place where you've been largely successful, how do you pivot how viable is Tesla? And I really am asking, I don't know, but if you take out all the regime subsidies, how profitable of an organization is this? Or has it all just been propped up with, you know, all the tax breaks?
You're asking the wrong question. Like Tesla is probably overvalued, and maybe he'll get his cash out. Maybe he doesn't. He doesn't have to be the world's richest man to make any of this possible. And he has been successful in a wide range of other things. SpaceX, obviously, which basically does most of the launches on the entire planet, orbital launches. So SpaceX, Starlink, earlier companies. And so he has the capabilities, among them the ability to hire and direct teams of people who and hold them accountable in a way that is extremely rare nowadays. Used to be much more common, but is eroded for a variety of reasons. So it doesn't matter. Like, if Tesla disappeared tomorrow, I would maintain the exact same thing. His health would greatly diminish, but fundamentally, he's been successful in repeated business enterprises, and it's those talents, or in part those talents, that I think are relevant. Yeah, it's nice that Tesla makes him the richest man in the world, but being the richest man in the world is really a secondary thing. He has to be rich. So, but you want to start to look for tells in his thinking as it changes. And I'm fond of saying that the ultimate tell is forming a private security force. That is, it makes perfect sense if he's down in Texas, and if he sees the regime starting to fall apart, that, well, we need to have a private security force. So he and Eric Prince or whoever get together and hire 20,000, you know, ex-special ops guys who are all super based, and they do like mall cop stuff. But everybody knows they're not meant as mall cops. But with the Texas government, you could get away with this. So again, he hasn't said anything like this, but it's inevitable that if you're a guy like Musk and if the premise is that he's decided the regime has to go, the question is, at what point do I take more aggressive action than I'm taking now? And when do I stop the angry tweets and start building the private security force? And if I was a betting man, having no information, it was probably right around the time that he made that tweet about reincorporating in Texas. Because again, I think that's a tell. Like if they stole from you a substantial portion of your livelihood that you had slaved over night and day for many years, reaching this ludicrous goal and being rewarded for it, and some fat HR ho Delaware chancery judge had just stolen from you, you would probably not say, you know, limit your reaction to I'm going to reincorporate my company in Texas because that'll show Delaware. I mean, that's not really what he was thinking. That's obvious. Right. What he was really thinking was probably something much more aggressive. I don't know. He doesn't call me up and talk to me.
That's interesting. So what would you, if you had to predict a timeline, what would you say for this private security force? When do you think that might happen?
I'm a I'm a big future optimist, but I'm also a very much a short-term pessimist in the sense that I expect the regime to start crumbling because it's fragile under the least pressure. So, and I expect that pressure to arise as pressures always arise soon. So if I was Musk, and I would basically wait to see what happens through the rest of 2024 and be making a few discreet inquiries about how it might be possible for me to assemble some guys who might help me out. Because I think that the necessary circumstances for that to happen are probably, if not exactly imminent, certainly in the near-term future, not in the 2030s.
At Private Family Banking, our mission is to help you set up your own privatized banking system so that you can prosper and pass along tax-free wealth to the next generation and teach them to be financially responsible with that wealth. Your system will guarantee positive and continuous growth of your money, income tax protected, for the rest of your life and beyond. Additionally, you will create a pool of capital that can be used to grow additional wealth using the same money in more than one place at the same time. For families, investors, and those near or already in retirement, your system will provide a buffer against market volatility to help you avoid selling off your investment portfolio during prolonged market downturns. Now, for those who are struggling with paying off high interest bearing credit cards or car loans or student loans, there's no worries. We'll teach you how to use your Private Family Bank to accelerate the payoff of your consumer debt, including a monthly step-by-step guide. Turning post-mill thinking into post-mill action with Private Family Banking. Now that's a good thing. Find out how this powerful approach to a multi-generational wealth building can work for you and your family by emailing banking@privatefamilybanking.com. You'll receive a free ebook and a link to schedule your free 30-minute consultation today. One more question regarding Musk. What do you think about the whole spat that happened over the ADL and advertising on Twitter? His initial reaction, I was a big fan of. I loved his response, you know, where he's just saying, like, well, forget them. You know, that's the Christian edited version of what he said. But, you know, these advertisers are going to pull out their advertising. They're going to leave, you know, your platform, right? And he's forget them, you know. And he's often also said, you know, that of course I overpaid for Twitter. But, you know, the $42 billion was not the price of Twitter. It was the price of freedom of speech, you know. And so even though I think Musk is, you know, there's plenty of, you know, some of his bedfellows. I mean, his associations with China, you know, Neuralink. I mean, I'm not a big fan of this idea of a chip in your brain. And so there's plenty of problems that I have with Musk, but if we're doing a comparison, much rather have him over, you know, one of the most important platforms for public discourse than someone like Jack Dorsey. So I'm very grateful in that regard. And I was also pleasantly surprised to see his reaction. It was just kind of like, I'm not going to be bullied. I reject your play. I'm not going to be bullied. But then a couple of weeks later, it seemed like he was going to be bullied. What do you think about that?
I mean, I didn't follow the specifics of that hugely closely, but I think it seems to me to be an inaccurate perception that he was bullied. That is, politics is the art of the possible, and fighting with everybody all the time is a mistake. So if Elon Musk wants to go hang out with Ben Shapiro and wear a yarmulke at the Wailing Wall to indicate that he doesn't hate all Jews, that's just a form of propaganda. And he has not made up with the advertisers. That is, he has not made up with the ADL. I think he may actually have an active lawsuit against the ADL. I'm not sure. He has so many lawsuits going at any given time. But or it may have been one of those things he talked about and didn't do, which he does actually very frequently. This is actually, I think, bad in a way, but it's a classic entrepreneurial thing. You're always trying things, and you know the number one most. This is a little bit off topic, but you'll see how it's really in a second. The number one most important characteristic for an entrepreneur probably is being decisive, and he talks about this a lot. Like, you must be continuously making decisions, even if the decisions are wrong, because that's what the other people want. The people under you demand you make decisions, and most people hate making decisions. So,
right.
I think that there is. Twitter, I think he's doing a fine job with Twitter. I think there's probably occasional missteps with people being censored. I think that he really needs to go back to the thing that he was originally talking about not just more transparency about limitations and bans, but also no permanent bans other than for, like, you know, obvious criminal activity or what have you. But I think that the fact that the people who are Musk haters, the people who are always saying, you know, he's controlled opposition and what have you, they have very little evidence for that. Most of that is they pick at these things that are more easily explainable as either just, you know, not part of an overall plan or something that's being done to pour oil on the waters rather than getting in fights all the time. And they say, well, that proves that he's worthless. I mean, the logical leap there is I think, you know, not supportable.
Okay. All right, let's move from Musk. Here's one more thing that I wanted to pick your brain on. Trump, I think he'll be president. What do you think?
Oh, yes. I keep reposting my tweet from last year saying, telling people to bookmark this tweet that Trump is guaranteed to be president unless he, like, actually dies.
Right.
No matter what, Trump will be president, and that significant social unrest will follow immediately follow that. So far,
right.
We're 6 or 7 months in from my tweet, and, you know, I feel strong retweeting it. I'll quietly delete it if it.
That's funny. But right now it's looking good.
Right now.
Yeah. So I completely agree with you. I think the only way I could see it not happening is if he dies, you know, natural causes, an accident, something like that. Or I do think that there's, I'm not saying it's a 50% like that high, but I think that there is a higher likelihood of Trump being assassinated than any other president since JFK.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean,
because I think that's the only way you can stop him. He has to physically die.
Yeah. I mean, you really got to hand it to the guy. Like, I couldn't do any, I mean, Trump is very defective in many ways. That's kind of obvious, but I just couldn't lead that guy's right. life. I mean, the amount of pressure and stress, he thrives on it. I prefer a quiet life in many ways, and
right.
he doesn't. That's good, I guess. But yeah, I totally right. agree. I mean, the chances of him getting popped are pretty high, unfortunately. But, you know.
Yeah. What's some of the unrest? Any specifics on that in terms of, you know, it just the liberal, you know, girls with blue hair falling to their knees and yell, you know, just more meme material or anything specific in terms of this unrest when Trump takes office?
One of the fundamental principles, and you see this throughout the 20th century and into the 21st century, is fundamental principles of the left is that progress can never move backwards. The ratchet only moves one way. And normally this works very well for them. And people have analyzed this. Aaron McIntyre talks about this a lot, the right. ratchet effect. But a corollary to that is that the left regards any actual or perceived diminution of their power as an existential threat justifying actual war. And in many cases requiring actual war. And you see this throughout history. My favorite example is actually the Finnish Civil War of 1918, of all things, where an obscure little civil war which killed 1% of the population of the country in 3 months. But it was started because the left was getting more and more power, and then they lost an election. And they immediately started a civil war. And even though most of the people on the left were like, it's pretty stupid to start a civil war because we're going to lose, which they did. But the left is always run not by some wise council of, you know, people, but by its most extreme elements. This is necessarily right. the case in all left movements. So it's necessarily the case that when Trump wins, actual violence of the civil war type, not like actual civil war, but like actual military style violence, as opposed to like blue-haired people screaming or even the kind of riots we saw after Trump's inauguration in 2016, is inevitable. Almost certainly you would have the kind of degenerate top military brass call for military action against Trump. You would have lots of low-level Antifa people doing it, much more kinetic kind of activity directed not at Trump directly, but at creating enough chaos that Trump would not be able to take office.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. Okay, let's go ahead and land the plane here. This has been really helpful. Who are some other voices, and not just, you know, not just the old dead guys, Lord knows we appreciate them, but some living people, not just authors, but guys who are talking, they're speaking places, they have a podcast or whatever that you think are insightful. Who are some people that we should listen to?
I think I mentioned one, which is Aaron McIntyre. Yeah, he has a YouTube channel.
I agree.
He does a lot of stuff.
I listen to him.
There's a young rising guy. I've actually been on his podcast. He was just on Andrew Klavan. Jay Burden, who's an Anon. Okay. He's 24, but he actually sounds very foundationalist. There's all kinds of stuff. He's not some kind of Haywood clone. But Jay Burden, it's the name is taken from Robert Penn Warren's book, All the King's Men. He's excellent. There's a bunch of other people too, but honestly, and I was just listening to him this morning. Those are two that really spring to mind.
Where is he? Where can I find him? Jay Burden.
YouTube. So Jay, the letter J, you know, period, B-U-R-D-E-N, Jay Burden.
Okay.
And I apologize to all the people who I regularly talk to and who are also excellent. There are many excellent people out there.
Right. Do you think that Oren will be able to stay on the Blaze long term? Do you have any predictions about that?
I predict yes.
That's great. Well, I think that says a lot about the Blaze.
Well, I have a beef with Glenn Beck because he libeled me last year on his radio program. But I can't be bothered to get out of bed to sue him. So, and I have a bunch of friends at the place. So, you know, I just, Glenn, right. You know, the boomer cons need to shuffle off, and Glenn Beck is a boomer con. So other than that, right. I love the place.
Yep. Yeah. Given the choice between the Blaze and Daily Wire, the Blaze. So, all right. Well, thank you so much. Where can our listeners follow you and your voice?
I have my own site, The Worthy House, theworthyhouse.com, where I write mostly book reviews or my own thoughts masquerading as book reviews. And I've written about 3 million words over the past 7 years. So you can spend all your time there if you're bored. And I also post on Twitter off and on. I try to stay off. It's not Orthodox Lent yet, but when it is Orthodox Lent, it's separated this year. I'll try to stay off Twitter a bunch because Twitter is, well, it's my only source of news now, one of my only sources of news. It's also the corrosive to the soul to spend too much time on Twitter.
That is true. As a Reformed Protestant during Lent, I always try to indulge in more things to protest the Pope.
But, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, to each his own. Was it
Martin Luther who said something about he realized that he had taken the irrevocable step when he ate sausages in Lent or something like that?
Right. Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of Protestant guys who they're like, we'll eat more bacon, you know, we'll do, you know, something like that. So but thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. And the Worthy House, is it theworthyhouse.com? Is that where they go? Worthyhouse.com. And then also I've listened to a few episodes in Audible form. If you go to Apple or Spotify, just search The Worthy House, and pretty much all of your writing you've also recorded
yes.
as an audio version.
Yep. That's correct.
All right. God bless. Thanks for coming on the show.